This is March 2nd, 2014, and I'm going to kick around some ideas about boredom today. This isn't just because of this harsh, endless winter that we find ourselves in that I suppose could be boring for some people when there's so much more in warmer months, so much more to do outdoors. On a plane trip last week, I was reminded again of how little people have to face boredom anymore with all of the devices that they have to occupy their minds. There's just a page here from The Atlantic. This was 4 years ago. But it sort of sums up the situation. And the title of the page is Boredom is Extinct. People used to talk about boredom as though it were a thing, not a mood, a sort of physical object. It descended on you. You escaped from it. You fled it. Or you dispelled it as though it were a fog. This, by the way, is an erroneous way of understanding it. There's no boredom apart from our own mind and the way we're using or misusing our mind. But he goes on, this wasn't always easy to do. Sometimes the boredom was just too thick, too, quote, heavy. Trapped in the back of a car on a long road trip, stuck on a flight without a book or magazine, or seated beside a dull stranger at a formal social gathering, the best you could do to lift the boredom, to muster a bit of leverage against its mass, was to imagine that you were somewhere else, or perhaps even someone else, doing something else. But suddenly, this old-fashioned trick has become unnecessary. Thanks to Twitter, iPads, Blackberries, voice-activated in-dash navigation systems, and 100 other technologies that offer distraction anywhere, anytime, boredom has loosened its grip on us at last. That once crushing weight has become, for the most part, a memory. Even the worst blind dates don't bore us now. We're never more than a click away from freedom, from an instantaneous change of conversation partners. Yeah, this is what always leaves such an impression on me when I'm traveling and in airports and planes is how people don't have to contend with boredom anymore. With all of these, the smartphones and everything else, you don't have to face yourself. If you always have something else to flee to. But then here he changes course I'll just read it. But what else has been lost? In other words, boredom, we've escaped boredom, never have to deal with boredom anymore. But what else has been lost? Creativity, just maybe. Because when one thinks about the matter, though we really have no reason to think about the matter or to think about anything since boredom disappeared, the keypad and the touch screen now do the work that used to be the business of the daydream. Remember daydreams? No, of course you don't. How could you? Three new text messages have just arrived, and another three in a moment will go out. So that's the end of this sort of introductory page. And right away, you see that he's defending somewhat the potential for states of boredom, as he says, as a kind of an avenue to greater creativity. You know, I have three more short articles besides that one, and I frankly was left somewhat confused about the different viewpoints, and I think it's because they're using boredom in different ways. When I think of boredom, I think of pain. It's painful to be bored. You remember when we were kids, it was just time dragged, and Mom, I don't have anything to do. What am I going to do? It's just painful. It's a painful state. The way he just used it, I think I would take it to mean more that it's that boredom can lead us because it's painful. It leads us into something that is a richer experience. Here's another article. I don't have a date on this one. It's New York Times. I just started clipping out articles about boredom a couple years ago. I must have been bored at the time. So this one, I don't have a date. But this is in the opinion page of the New York Times. Is by a Peter Tui, who's a professor of Greek and Roman studies at the University of Calgary and the author of Boredom, A Lively History. And he starts by talking about a 33-year-old chimpanzee in this zoo in Sweden that likes to collect rocks before the zoo opens each day, and he piles them up on the visitor side of his island, and then he starts pitching rocks at the people, and the author here suggests that it's because he's bored. He said boredom, as I like to think, the name of the chimpanzee is Santino. Boredom, as I like to think Santino illustrates, is a pretty straightforward emotion. It's a product of predictability and of unavoidable and unchanging circumstances. And if there's no break from the boredom, it can easily spill over into anger and even violence. There's a message here. Avoid situations that may produce boredom, or rocks are liable to fly. And then he says, simple boredom has a very long history. It's not, as many argue, just a modern malaise. In fact, it's a universal emotion that was just as evident in antiquity as it is in animals. And then he quotes, remember this is a professor of classics, he quotes some inscription from ancient times that refers to boredom. I have to do a lot of skipping through these articles to stay within our limits, our time limits. I won't read that one. And then he suggests that he says these days it often seems that it's young people who complain most about boredom. I don't know if that's true. I'm not around enough young people who don't practice Zen. It sure doesn't look that way because they always have their devices to go to. But anyway, let's let him finish his point. It's young people that complain most about boredom. Why so? Do the many means of stimulation in this age of instant entertainment make it much harder for them to keep interested and absorbed? Well, only if they, this is me speaking, only if they don't have their device in hand. He says, perhaps. He says their boredom is more likely to result from the collision of their exuberant young lives with an adult insistence that they buckle down, not always reasonably, to the demands of the grown-up world. And then he says, so if you see a young person assuaging a case of boredom with graffiti, don't blame the age of the Xbox. The motive may be the same as that of the Roman graffitist who wrote 2,000 years ago, and this here he's quoting the graffiti, "Wall, I wonder that you haven't fallen down in ruin when you have to support all the boredom of your young inscribers. And then he says, graffiti is often a product of the idle vandalism of youth suffering a boredom not unlike that of their ancient predecessors. Suffering, there it is again, suffering a boredom. It's painful to be bored. He says, maybe this link with the very young is why boredom often produces such unsympathetic and incredulous responses in adults, and why its beneficial possibilities are so often missed. Who would wish to share such an emotion with a mere child? Instead, grown-ups will sometimes complain that they suffer not from simple boredom, but from an existential boredom. Now we're going to get into more of the territory of spiritual practice. This form of spiritual boredom is a very serious matter indeed. It was once quite fashionable, and it still exudes an exotic world weariness, much more impressive than to simply say, I'm bored. Existential boredom, it is claimed, can infect a person's very existence with unrelieved emptiness, isolation, and alienation. And these states, of course, are also painful. If you're feeling life as empty and you're feeling isolated and alienated, but I think he's right that it's different from the kind of ordinary daily life boredom experienced by the young. This has got a lot more depth to it and a lot more potential in it to reach a point where life seems to have no meaning. And in that depth of a sense of a loss, maybe we could say, is coiled all kinds of possible transformation, because we learn in coming to practice that you have to reach a certain level of dissatisfaction. Actually, that's another word for boredom. They have to go together, boredom and dissatisfaction. So boredom, we could say, is another form of dukkha. Dukkha, the first of the Four Noble Truths, which is usually translated as suffering, but is better translated as a dissatisfaction or unease. Boredom can be seen as a form of dukkha, anxiety, frustration. Actually, frustration and boredom have some similarities between them. But reaching a point of a feeling that life is empty and one is isolated and alienated, this has great, this can fuel spiritual practice in the purest sense. This goes beyond mere, this takes us beyond mere mindfulness. Although mindfulness is certainly a cure for boredom. And then skipping a couple paragraphs here, he says, in real life, boredom acts as an early warning that certain situations may be dangerous to human well-being. It's not unlike disgust, another emotion that helps humans prosper. Just as disgust stops you from eating what is noxious, so boredom in social settings alerts you to situations that can do no psychological good. Boredom, interpreted properly, might act as an alarm. It urges you to step back. And here I would suggest that another response when you're bored in a social situation is to step forward. Find a way to get more engaged with that person. Use your imagination. Come up with some way of bringing something out in that person so you don't just have to listen to his or her droning and feel like you're helpless. Use your imagination. And I think that exactly is an example of what our first writer, where he talked about creativity, his boredom as a way to prompt creativity, is that it's the very pain of boredom that makes us not want to linger in it, to find a way out. And that's what the Four Noble Truths are really offering us, a way out. That's the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. The first is dukkha, frustration, anxiety, pain, one kind or another. And the last is there's a way out. There's an old saying from Outward Bound, which was a outdoor adventure program for troubled youth. It went like this: if you can't get out of it, get into it. If you're with someone who's boring you to death, either get into it or out of it. But don't just suffer there. Find a way. That's the best thing, is find a way to get in. What human being, when we get into the heart of that person, could be boring? There's this mysterious, unfathomable complexity and richness to every human being. So the better thing is to see if you can stimulate something from that person that can lift you out of your boredom. Another way in that situation to get more engaged is to listen better. I think often with a boring person, people check out mentally. They're not listening. They're just saying, "Oh, here's this boring person who's rah, 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 rah. What am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? What can I?" That's all just separation on the part of the listener. See if you can find a way to get in, listen better. And if you can't, then if you can't get into it, get out of it. But he presses his point. So perhaps boredom is designed to encourage people to adapt their behavior and protect them from social toxins, just as its first cousin, disgust, is designed, biologically speaking, to cause people to adapt their behavior to real physical toxins. Perhaps boredom should be viewed just as gout sometimes is, or angina, or even mild strokes, as a sign of worse things to follow unless there's a change in lifestyle. Actually, another very, very short article I clipped out some time ago. The title is "Being Bored Could Lead to Bad Health." And it's a report from the International Journal of Epidemiology that experts say there's a possibility the more bored you are, the more likely you are to die early. Enough of that one. And then he says elsewhere, I'm still with the Peter Tuohy article, and boredom has other less spectacular benefits. The Airman Dunbar, this is from Catch 22, the Airman Dunbar thought it was good for longevity by slowing the passage of time. That must be facetious, because who who, when they're bored, finds that it slows the pace. The time seems to drag when we're bored, and this is where I agree with this writer that boredom can be used as a great feedback device in sitting. Let's go to sitting for a minute. If you're sitting and you're bored, that is a sure sign that you're not engaged enough with the breath or the koan or whatever you're doing. And really, sitting is the ultimate test of boredom. Because what could be more boring than facing a blank wall and unable to move? But more important than the circumstances of facing a blank wall and unable to move, more important than that is the mind and how we use or misuse the mind. And that when we are concentrated and not separated, not lost in thoughts, but we're really concentrated on the practice, that we can go for hours and hours and days facing a blank wall without being bored. Or maybe periodically experiencing some boredom, but then learning by and by that our boredom is our responsibility. It's our fault if we're bored. This is a huge lesson to learn through meditation, is that it is the mind, more than circumstances, it's the mind that determines our experience, the quality of our lives at any given moment. But now, then he talks about how the pain of boredom can prompt us to go beyond it. So he says, boredom can also encourage innovation. It can breed dissatisfaction, there's that word again, with ways that are intellectually shopworn. It can drive the thoughtful to question the accepted and to seek out beneficial change. And daydreaming, it's often a byproduct of boredom. Yeah, but here, from a Zen perspective, that is no ultimate solution to boredom, is daydreaming. That's the problem when we're doing Zazen, is fleeing into our daydreams. And that may work for a while. I've heard people who report getting so bored when they're sitting doing Zazen that they find all kinds of fantasies and daydreams they go into, and that can work for a while, but really betrays the real possibility, the promise of meditation practice, is to not give way to daydreams. They can be entertaining, but certainly they are not a way of really breaking through boredom, which is different from just fleeing it, but going straight into it and through it, and certainly coming to awakening. That's not likely to happen if you flee into your daydreams. And then he ends, he says, boredom should not be abused, exploited, ignored, sneered at, rejected, or talked down to as a product of laziness or of an idle, uninventive, and boring mind. It's there to help, and its advice should be welcomed and acted upon. That's what we just talked about, as a signal that you need to get more engaged. But then he says that many of us suffer from it should be no cause for embarrassment. Boredom deserves respect for the beneficial experience that it is. It's not a beneficial experience. It can lead to lead us out of the pain of it. It's just like pain in our legs when we're sitting. Yes, it's true, with physical pain it can concentrate the mind, but its real potential is as a way to show us that we are not bound to the conditions. We're not bound to pain. We're not bound to boredom, pain in the form of boredom. We're not bound to physical pain. We're not bound to the pain of boredom. But I insist that boredom itself, the experience of boredom, is only beneficial in as much as we can find a way beyond it. And here's another article. This is also from the New York Times Book Review. And this is, the title is Our Boredom, Ourselves. and another scholar I read insists that boredom is a more recent thing. You may remember with this other guy, Peter Tui, he said that it's not, as many argue, just a modern malaise. It's a universal emotion, also evident in antiquity. Here I think we get into some semantic issues, but this new writer, Jennifer Schlussler, says, boredom, like the modern novel, was born in the 18th century and came into full flower in the 19th. Boredom, scholars argue, was something new, different from the dullness, lassitude, and tedium people had no doubt been experiencing for centuries. In her ingenious study, Boredom, the Literary History of a State of Mind, Patricia Meyer Spax describes it as a luxury and a peril born of the Industrial Revolution, reflecting the rise of individualism, leisure, and the idea of happiness as a right and a daunting personal responsibility. And then this author writes, boredom presents itself as a trivial emotion that can trivialize the world. It implies an embracing sense of irritation and unease. It reflects a state of affairs in which the individual is assigned ever more importance and ever less power. I think there's really something to this, her linking this to modern, this congealing sense of individualism that was not the same in ancient times. Human beings were not always so, they didn't define themselves anywhere as we do now as individuals, but rather were, they did not separate themselves cognitively, much more certainly of the family, of the tribe. Even now, many countries are much more, they identify, their sense of identity comes from the country, the nation they live in, such as Japan, than the individual identity. Yeah, and then this author, reviewer, says, in Saul Bellow's Humboldt's Gift, the narrator, a writer who spends the final Eisenhower years trying to write the definitive treatise on boredom, describes it as a kind of pain caused by unused powers, the pain of wasted possibilities or talents, accompanied by expectations of the optimum utilization of capacity. So the coming together of expectation or some awareness of our potential with the lack of that, the unused nature of that. A kind of pain caused by unused powers. This is how we can see it when we're doing zazen. Not just zazen. I am always talking about zazen because it's sort of the quintessential mode of Zen practice. But it's really Zen practice is goes on all the time. It's not just when we're seated in a certain posture. Unused powers, wasted possibilities or talents. This is our innate capacity to become one with. We all have that ability. And if we're bored, it means we're not using it. Because if we were one with our circumstances, or the person we're talking to, or the conditions, like an endless winter, if we're one with it, then we would not be experiencing it as boring. And then she says, but boredom may itself be a highly useful human capacity, at least according to some psychologists and neuroscientists who have begun examining it not just as an accomplice to depression and addiction, but as an important source of creativity, well-being, and our very sense of self. There's that creativity again. Boredom as, I would say, as a prod, because it's painful, a prod into using our powers of creativity more. And this is what we find in doing zazen, that if we just languish in our thoughts, then we're likely to be bored, or time is likely to drag. But if we can get beyond our thoughts, underneath them, you could, in a sense, into the depths of the mind that are beyond thought, then we tap into our creative potential. There's no doubt about this. This is one of the, I say this at every workshop these days, that besides the obvious benefits of meditation, reducing stress, developing greater concentration, stabilizing the emotions, the real promise of meditation is to offer us a fresh perspective. And that can be when we feel we're stuck in the box of thought, that if we can find our way out of that, which we do through the breath or the koan, if we can get beyond that, then we can reach the creative well that is within us to some degree or another. I'm not saying that we all can be painters or composers, but there is a way in which we can get beyond the rational mind and open up other avenues of perspectives. The reviewer continues, researchers have discovered that when people are conscious but doing nothing, for example, lying in an MRI scanner, waiting to be given some simple mental task as part of a psychology experiment, the brain is in fact firing away with greater activity in regions responsible for recalling autobiographical memory, imagining the thoughts and feelings of others, and conjuring hypothetical events. Now this is interesting, because if we plug in Zazen, when people are conscious but doing nothing. So she gives as an example an MRI scanner. We can use as an example doing Zazen, conscious but doing nothing. The brain is firing away with greater activities. And listen to the regions respond that this is happening in. The regions responsible for recalling autobiographical memory. So thoughts about the self, reflecting back, recalling things, the I, the me, the my, imagining the thoughts and feelings of others, and conjuring hypothetical events. So these are common sorts of thoughts that come to us when we're sitting. Some people, every once in a while, someone will report to me, usually in Doksan, that they find that it is harder to concentrate when they're sitting than during keening. And I think this might offer an explanation of why that sometimes is. I've always understood that as really becoming more aware. When you're sitting and not moving and facing the wall, you become more aware of thoughts. Because again, you're conscious but doing nothing. But once you're doing something, doing kinhin, working, then it could be understandable that people would not be as aware of their thoughts, and so they think that they're concentrating better when they're moving around. It's always a matter of how aware we are of the thought activity that's going on. When this so-called default mode network is activated, that means what's going on when we're conscious but doing nothing, when that's activated, the brain uses only about 5% less energy than it does when engaged in basic tasks. But that discrepancy may explain why time seems to pass more slowly at such moments. It may also explain the agitated restlessness that compels the bored to seek relief in doodling or daydreaming. She continues, it's common to decry our collective phasophobia, or fear of boredom, manifested in our addiction to iPhone apps, the cable news crawl, and ever-mutating varieties of multitasking. One cell phone company has even promoted the idea of micro-boredom, which refers to those moments of inactivity that occur when we're, say, stuck waiting in line for a latte without our BlackBerry. Heaven forbid. But novelists, for all their own fears of being dismissed as boring, continue to offer some bold resistance to the broader culture's zero-tolerance boredom eradication program. Let's just go back to that waiting in line, because we all have to wait in line, don't we? At times, supermarket or at the coffee shop or anywhere. So there, right there is an opportunity. 9 out of 10 people will stand there with their head hanging, entranced by their electronic device, and that's their solution. But consider another one, standing while you're waiting and observing people, surroundings, noticing, exercising mindfulness, awareness, being attuned, looking around, being plugged into not just this electronic device, but what's going on. You can see some interesting things happening. The faces, people's faces alone, every face tells a story. Look at it. Look at people. Better not stare at them, because that can be a problem. But you don't have to stare. You can, in a glance, you can see a lot of a person's suffering and beauty, just in taking in what's around you. And then she says that boredom can seem as something more strenuous and exalted than the friendly helper depicted by the neuroscientists, keeping our minds revved up even when we think we're idling. Boredom isn't just good for your brain, it's good for your soul. Bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude at the gift of being alive, conscious, lies on the other side of crushing boredom. David Foster Wallace wrote in a note left with the manuscript, I had to skip over this, a manuscript called The Pale King. Let's go back to that. So here too is where I think that when these writers are saying that boredom is good for you, I think it's only as the means, not an end in itself. Who wants to be languishing in boredom? It's good for you as a means to get beyond it. It's sort of like reaching a point that many of us, well, I don't know how many, but I'll just speak for myself. I got to the point when I was 21 years old or so where I just was sick of myself. And it's that sickness that prompted me to find a way out, to find the Dharma. And find the medicine, the cure. And that's where we can say that boredom is not without some benefit as a means to get beyond it. So that's what I think it... she means as boredom isn't just good for your brain, it's good for your soul. And then bliss on the other side of it. This is engagement, oneness, a second-by-second joy and gratitude of the gift of being alive lies on the other side of crushing boredom. These are the words of David Foster Wallace. Wallace continues, pay close attention to the most tedious thing you can find, and again, that most tedious thing potentially is facing a wall, pay close attention to the most tedious thing you can find, and then in parentheses, David Foster Wallace writes, tax returns, televised golf, and in waves, a boredom like you've never known will wash over you and just about kill you. Ride these out, and it's like stepping from black and white into color, like water after days in the desert. Instant bliss in every atom. These are words that suggest that he's been there. He's experienced what's on the other side of boredom. Trouble is, most people don't know how to get on the other side of boredom, except to just lapse into their electronic devices. And about those electronic devices, there's another longer article from the New Yorker of last year, October 28th, 2013, by a Evgeny Morozov, and I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs from this. He starts by, if it is a he, Evgeny, starts by quoting Siegfried Krakauer, a luminary in the literary world of the Weimar Republic in 1924. Talking about, he wrote an essay, no, I'll just read what he said rather than try to trace this back through another writer. he talked about how at that time radio was the big thing, and he said that radio listeners were in a state of permanent receptivity, constantly pregnant with London, the Eiffel Tower, and Berlin, their souls badgered by the news hounds, so that soon no one can tell anymore who is the hunter and who is the hunted. This is, I think, a good description of to the nth degree how things are now with all of these forms of entertainment and electronic diversions. And then I'm skipping here, and then this Evgeny, the author of this New Yorker article, says these days the quote state of permanent receptivity has become the birthright of anyone with a smartphone. We are under constant assault by interestingness, as new media aficionados, curators they call themselves, prowl for bizarre factoids and quaint cartoons. The anti-boredom lobby has all but established its headquarters in Silicon Valley. Cue Facebook's celebration of a, quote, more connected world, or Apple's reassurances that its latest gadget could do everything twice as fast. Google is so boredom-averse that it seems to change its logo every day. Now you're never lonely because your friends are always reachable, Eric Schmidt, Google's executive chairman, declared a few years ago. You're never bored because there's infinite streams of information and entertainment. In his book, The New Digital Age, he writes that those feeling bored can always turn on the holograph box and visit Carnival in Rio. But the ultimate anti-boredom device is Google Glass, a pair of smart spectacles that can overlay infinite streams of information on anything in our visual field. Google Now, another flagship service, wants to hijack the now by paralyzing everything we've done in the past to predict what we might be doing in the future. Krakauer's recipe for boredom, draw the curtains and get to know your sofa. This is this is Krakauer from 1924. Doesn't work in the heavily mediated homes of today. Try the sofa experiment with Kinect. These are capital letters. I don't know what they are. Try the sofa experiment with Kinect, the Xbox, and the Roku player by your side. Meanwhile, the Bored at Work Network, as Jonah Peretti, a founder of BuzzFeed, once described the millions of people who are making his site's stories go viral, the Bored at Work Network toils to push the latest meme into your inbox. The world outside offers no relief. Your leisurely walk to the train station might be an even greater amusement trap, what with the glowing billboards that recognize your face, news feeds that beam on giant screens above your head, and smart gadgets that inform you when they detect the latest deals from shops and restaurants nearby. And then in parentheses he writes, yes, Google has an app for that. It's called Field Trip. And then he says, information overload can bore us as easily as information underload. But this form of boredom, mediated boredom, doesn't provide time to think. It just produces a craving for more information in order to suppress it. All right. Some food for thought, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.